Hello everyone and welcome to episode 135 of the History Heartline. My name is Deanna Lynn Cook and as always I'll be your host today. So over the past few weeks I've been thinking and reading about mobilisations in the Caribbean in the 1970s and 80s, movements in kind of line with Black Power, also with Marxist-Leninist movements, within socialism, and all these movements saw mass uprisings of working people on different Caribbean islands, fighting for better conditions, working against imperialism, colonialism, and essentially fighting for some form of equality that would improve their lives and the lives of those generations that would follow. Now, I didn't want to do another episode on anything relating, like, specifically to Caribbean history, although I guess you can kind of define a lot of things as Caribbean history when it's pertaining to Caribbean people. But I do feel like I've been neglecting Black British history over the past few months, or dare I say even longer. I actually can't remember the last episode that was, like, solely focused on an event or a person or something that happened within Black British history. But that being said, I was thinking about mobilizations, and this led to thoughts about mobilizations more broadly, and uprisings of people when the big and powerful and moneyed institutions and powers that be and governments that we may or may not have chosen to elect simply don't listen to us as the people, or historically listen to working people, the working classes, their demands, the marginalised, and what they kind of are seeking and what they need. And I'm thinking now about marches that have been going on in England, especially in regards to what's happening in the Democratic Republic of Congo, in Sudan, in Gaza, in Palestine, and of course more widely. And the fact that so many people over so many months and years continue to stand up, be counted for, to march, to chant, to shout, to sing for better, not necessarily for themselves, but because they believe, truly believe, in a world that looks different to the one we have now, a better world. They have dreams, hopes, and can see a better future, and are going to exercise their democratic right to protest in order to get it. And in, I say more modern times, but in the context of literally right now, when this episode is coming out at the end of April 2024, I'm thinking about what's happening on university campuses across America and also in Britain in terms of the protests and encampments for what's happening in Palestine. And also then the way the state, the police are so desperately trying to crush the revolutionary spirit of students and of faculty, in regards to speaking freely about the genocide that's happening in Palestine, about, you know, their right to protest and their right to take up space and to make noise, in regards to what is going on. Thinking about places like Columbia, like City University of New York, University of Pennsylvania, Northwestern, Princeton, Ohio, Cornell, UCLA, Warwick in the UK, and so many more. If you literally type in the word encampment on Twitter and have a look through the kind of videos and pictures, minus the overzealous police presence and the snipers, it's actually really heartwarming to see people still standing up for Palestinians and for wider calls for justice, anti-imperialism, and for equality. These students, faculty members, they're occupying their campuses, they are facing arrest, police brutality, and other ramifications from their universities and law enforcement. So if you don't know anything about that, have a listen and find out, because today I'm going to be drawing parallels with protesting and people rising up for equality. There's lots of thoughts, as you can probably tell, swimming in my mind, and I'm really parting with everything that's happening in my brain right now. But as I was scrolling on Instagram, this was a few months ago actually, I saw a post from the George Padmore Institute, and they often share their archival material, so do have a follow of them on Instagram. I really do enjoy their page. And they posted about the People's Day of Action, which would have been January, its anniversary. It happened in 1981. And I thought, yes, I need to make an episode about this. But it wasn't until more recently when I was thinking about protesting and the kind of, I guess not the history of protesting, because I could go all the way back, all the way back, all the way back. But in Britain, when it comes to Black people, because that's primarily what this podcast is all about. And I was thinking about the People's Day of Action and what a remarkable kind of day it was. There is already a podcast on the New Cross Massacre, episode 19, New Cross Fire, I think it's titled. It's not a long episode, and I think I only mention in passing the aftermath of the fire and the People's Day of Action. So this is an episode that, you know, what, 3 years later, gives more detail about the protests that follows and how they kind of organised and how community organised itself to stand up for what had happened and for the world to take notice. If you don't know anything about the New Cross Fire, then I would listen to that episode first, maybe. That's episode 19. I think it was an early 2021 episode. Bear with me if you do listen. That was 3 years ago. My thoughts were formulated in the context of 2021. And yeah, listen with merciful ears, please. Welcome to the History Hotline, a direct line to a better understanding of all things Black history and beyond. On the 18th of January 1981, Yvonne Ruddock was celebrating her 16th birthday party at 439 New Cross Road in South East London, her family home. And the fire, known as the New Cross Fire or the New Cross Massacre, killed 13 young black people, injuring countless more. The subsequent trauma led to another person, Anthony Birbeck, dying by suicide in following years. Given the high degree of racial tension in New Cross at the time, it was assumed that this was a racist arson attack. However, investigations saw police blaming and targeting the partygoers, arrests were not forthcoming, and the local and wider community felt the police and society more largely were indifferent to the tragedy, despite the fact that 13 young British children had died. Black British children, that is. To this day, no one has ever been charged with starting the fire. But that isn't the point of this episode, and wasn't the point of the episode that I mentioned that I did before on the New Cross Fire. The mobilisations that followed the fire, led by black community organisers in South East London and in the country more widely, is the point of today's episode.
13 dead and nothing said.
13 dead and nothing said.
13 dead and nothing said.
The New Cross Fire was one of the biggest tragedies in British history.
On March the 2nd, 1981, we black people took to the streets to stand up for our rights. We were fighting for justice for the victims of the fire, as well as the freedom and liberty to be treated like human beings. Thousands of black people marched from New Cross to Whitehall.
Racism was an everyday occurrence back then. We had Thatcher, as well as the likes of the police and the National Front to contend with.
But on that day, enough was enough.
It was a day of action that will never be forgotten.
It was a pinnacle moment where for the first time society had to see and hear us.
Although this day will forever be a victory, discrimination continues to riddle this country 40 years on. Therefore, we must stand united, ensure our voices are never silenced, fight for our existence and demand equality.
The protests that followed the fire led to a mobilisation of black political activity. And on March the 2nd, 1981, there was the inaugural Black People's Day of Action. The New Cross Massacre Action Committee, that was chaired by publisher John LaRose and founder of New Beacon Books, led a march from the scene of the fire and into central London. There were around 20,000 people coming from areas like Birmingham, Manchester, and even as far as France, marching across London to demand that their voices were heard, to demand justice for the victims of the New Cross Fire, and insist that establishments like the press, the police, the powers that be listened to the black community and actually took some time to remember and care for the young children that had lost their lives. In the aftermath of the fire, the black community in Lewisham believed that, in some cases anyway, it was a neo-fascist far-right National Front who had committed an arson attack on the house party, using arson as a method of stoking fear and exacerbating the already very tense racial tensions at a time where racial tensions were, you know, very much heightened. We have the benefit of 43 years of hindsight, and we know later in 1981 that riots broke out in many major cities across the UK. Young people who felt so let down, victimised, racialised, bullied and oppressed by the state and the police exploded in a way. And we saw uprisings in 1981. The New Crossfire fits quite easily, I would say, into this building racial tension, especially as it happened in January. January coming off of the back of Christmas, a time of celebration, a time of joy. And then this fire happens that is believed to be an arson attack within the context of South East London, where suspicions are very much pointed towards the far right. And the police and the national press, when they are finally given some press coverage, point the finger at partygoers and the black community, again, heightening these racial tensions and confirming fears that society really didn't care for them as black people, for their children and their lives. It further stoked and built onto the racial stereotypes towards West Indian communities. It fed into anti-immigrant and anti-black rhetoric at a time where immigration bills were being debated in the Houses of Parliament and conversations were very similar as they are now when it came to immigrants in Britain. Anti-black rhetoric was also very much alive and very loud. One of the main issues with the aftermath of the fire was the lack of concern or care coming from the British state. I think if the term Black Lives Matter had been coined back then, it would have had to have had like a question mark after it, because the community did not feel like their children's lives mattered. They did not feel that their safety mattered. They didn't feel like Black Lives Mattered at all. In the immediate aftermath of the fire, Sybil Phoenix, leader of the Moonshot Youth Club, foster mother to hundreds of children, as well as all-round activist, protector of the community and woman of great faith, to say the least, opened up the Paginal Street Community Centre in liaison with the police in order to open up a space for the community, to allow them to kind of have a physical space to take stock of what had happened in the immediate aftermath of the fire, to grieve in some ways, to mourn, to process. And Sybil Phoenix did a lot in that kind of immediate aftermath, as well as later on following what had happened and heading into the Black People's Day of Action. Her aims were to protect the community, but also to protect Amza Ruddock, who had organised the party for her children, Yvonne's mother. She was she had two children at that moment, at the immediate aftermath of the fire, that were in a critical condition in hospital, Yvonne, who was 16, and Paul, who was 22. They did later pass from their injuries sustained in the fire, but at that moment, she had two critically ill children that were fighting for their lives. Now, interestingly enough, and I think it's a story that kind of is often forgotten with the aftermath of the New Cross fire, is that Amza Ruddock ends up on the news very quickly afterwards. I believe it's around 48 hours after the fire. She's on Alex Pascal's BBC radio show Black Londoners to be interviewed. And at this point, there are, as I said, her two children that are in a critical condition, other children and adults that are severely injured, fighting for their lives as well. And I think around 10 young people at this point, had been confirmed to have died. This interview that this mother, Amza Ruddock, is having to give at this point is insane. It's insane because she's clearly, it doesn't take anyone to realise, understand mentally what she'd be going through at that moment. And the reason she is urged or feels it's necessary that she goes on Black Londoners on this radio show is that the kind of blame was being put on the community for having this party, blaming things like, you know, Caribbean people having these late parties, having these loud parties, and asking questions as to why they're even having a party in the first place, as if it wasn't clear that it was a 16-year-old's birthday party. You know, questions she's having to deal with and respond to are about if people are drinking, were drinking, was it noisy? You know, was everybody on the guest list? Were there gatecrashers? Who had come? Where were they from? It's not, you know, to check in on her, which you wouldn't need to do on live radio anyway. But the line of questioning and the way in which she's essentially having to defend her family, the community, for having a party for a 16-year-old girl's birthday, whilst her two children are in a critical condition and would later die of their injuries from the fire, is, I think, so vile, for want as a better word, but just highlights something that the black community had been saying for so long, is that they're, you know, over-policed as suspects and underprotected as victims. In a time where young people have died, Amza Riddick is having to defend the community, defend her family, defend what has happened. At a time where it's largely believed that it's an arson attack, and she's having to go live on London radio to speak. It's absolutely insane to me that that happened. Like, I physically can't believe it. There's some things you read in history, like, that, no, even they couldn't go that low. But they did, and it just really shows the care, the level of care, I think that's the best word for it, the care, and how much care there was for the trauma of those that were going through it. The community at whole was suffering. Black people, you know, as a whole, were feeling this, and people, anyone with empathy, would have been feeling this. This is young people losing their lives at a birthday party, a point of celebration. But the fact that this mother, Amza Riddick, and I'm being very deliberate in saying her name, and I'm also being deliberate in referring to the people, the victims of this fire, by name, because I think their names often get swept up in the wider story. And whilst there is, of course, a wider history and a wider story, we have to commemorate their lives. And I think that can be done by saying their names. But I think it essentially just shows how little care there was for black people at this time. Now, as we kind of continue on into the aftermath, the less immediate and the kind of weeks and days that follow, there's a group, Black Alliance is a group made up of the Black Parents Movement, the Black Youth Movement, and some of the Race Today Collective. And they meet at the Pagnell Street Community Centre, which was actually the old Moonshot Youth Club, which I mentioned before, that Sybil Phoenix ran. And that burnt down in December 1977, which was suspected to be an arson attack by the National Front, which is just so interesting to me. Can you kind of imagine the significance of holding this meeting in a space that's so close geographically to the fire that took place at Yvonne Ruddock's 16th birthday party on New Cross Road, and in a space that was also suspected to have been damaged by the same racist terror meted out by the far right in 1980s Britain? There are clear parallels here, and I think the importance of space within this story is definitely clear, with this Black Alliance, you know, choosing to open this Pagnell Street Community Centre, choosing to use it, despite the fact that it was, I believe, unfurnished. It wasn't properly, like, finished being fixed up yet. So they're using this space despite the fact that it's probably not quote-unquote ready. But the significance of it, and I think what that might have done to the kind of spirit of resistance and of the desire and the kind of anger, I can't imagine it being much further than anger, frustration, pain, from what had happened and the lack of response from anyone, really. Following on from the fire, there were also regional sections of the New Cross Action Committee, which I mentioned earlier. Most of them were in London, so within, like, north, south, east, west, basically, of London, kind of regionally organising, but also outside of London in Rugby. And I want to kind of mention Rugby. Rugby being a very pertinent place, and also linking to this tragedy. It's important because of the family link between the Ruddock family, who were from Rugby and had moved to London. Last year, 2023, a full exhibition went up in Rugby at Rugby Art Gallery Museum in order to commemorate the lives lost and the presence of people from Rugby at the Black People's Day of Action in 1981 was most definitely noted. In a Voice article by Sanai Fleary that came out last January, that's January 2023, titled New Crossfire Survivors Call for National Memorial, does a good job in detailing the links between the Ruddock family of London and their links to Rugby. And it's Lorna Tavares, who is the first cousin to the family, speaking in an interview with Sanai Fleary, I'm assuming, for the article. And she talks about the fact that there were seven injured survivors from Rugby, and also Rugby, in a sense, lost four young people that night. And so mourning in Rugby would have also been as painful and as pertinent as it might have been to that close South London community. The two people that passed away that I haven't mentioned from Rugby are 16-year-old Patrick Cummings and 18-year-old Humphrey Brown, and then of course Yvonne Ruddock and Paul Ruddock, who had moved to London with their family originally from Rugby. A lot of people don't tend to know that the majority of the victims and those injured had a link to Rugby. And this is a point that Robert Ruddock, who was the older brother of Yvonne and Paul, spoke about in that same article. And he said, and I quote, "It's a shared family tragedy between London and Rugby, but that bit has always been silenced because people telling their stories don't know the family and friends." And I think that's quite an interesting and pertinent point raised by Robert, speaking, 42 years on from the fire. And the way that the story has been told, him kind of referring to the erasure of the people, which is part of the reason also that I am quite big on naming the people that I'm speaking about and to actually give them life, give them faces, give them names. Me, myself and I didn't know that there was such a strong link to Rugby. And I think it does speak to the wider spread feeling of tragedy, as you can kind of see and like begin to map out the links of between West Indian people in Britain and the way they show up for each other. I didn't know of this link until I had a conversation with fellow PhD student who've got a shout out, Holly Cooper. And it's a link I think we should speak a little bit more about, because not only does it descend to London within certain narratives of black organising, which Holly does amazing work to do within their own PhD. I think we should also speak more of this link following on from Robert's comments in regards to humanising the stories of those who lost their lives, which isn't done very well typically when it comes to the events surrounding Yvonne's 16th birthday party. There were also other groups that mobilised outside of London, not just Rugby, cities like Leicester, Manchester, Birmingham, I'm sure, again showing links of groups across the country coming together to stand up for a better response to the fire. Now, you might be thinking, what was the response? Like, why? Why was it so bad? Why did people feel like they needed to stand up and protest? You know, the fire had happened. Yes, the police hadn't found anyone, but so what? Well, Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher at the time and then monarch Queen Elizabeth II did not comment or send condolences privately or publicly for those who lost their lives, for the children. There was no public acknowledgement to the devastation of the community. And it very loudly, really and truly, I don't see how you can take it any other way. It said we don't care. It said we don't give a heck. That's what it said, very loudly and very clearly. Because for young people to die in such a horrific way, their mom to be on the radio, defending the community and the birthday party the next day, and then to hear nothing from Margaret Thatcher, the Prime Minister. And I don't know how it works with like royal people, the monarch, Queen Elizabeth II, that is, commenting on things that have happened within society. I will be sharing examples shortly of prime ministers and how they tend to respond typically. But, you know, it really did loudly and clearly say, like, we don't care. It said we don't care about black children's lives. It fed into the narrative of blame being spun by the media. All media coverage was about essentially, you know, blaming the community, blaming Caribbean people for the way they were living, blaming it on immigration being out of control, as opposed to actually taking a second to think about the trauma that people were going through, having lost children, lost family members, lost friends. Now, Sybil Phoenix astutely in a interview, I think it was quoted in West Indian World, issue 498, that came out in mid-Feb 1981, which was cited by Dr. Aaron Andrews in a talk he did for Cambridge University Press in a YouTube video that I watched, posted in June 2021, just to cite my sources. She said, and I quote, "If a dog's home was attacked and 12 dogs burnt, the press would be asking, how could dogs be treated this way? Some time ago, a kennel was burnt down and a surviving kitten made the news for days. Yet we have a situation where black people have been murdered, and to date there have not even been any messages of sympathy from the Prime Minister of this country." In February the 14th, 1981, there was another fire at the Stardust nightclub in Dublin. There were 48 deaths and around 200 people were injured. Margaret Thatcher sent a letter of condolences to the families of those who lost loved ones in Ireland. And questions again were asked as to why this was not done in the previous month when black children had died in a fire. It highlighted just how very blatantly the state did not care about black life. And also, which was even more scary to me looking back, how little they even pretended to care. Because realistically, if they didn't care, which was very clear, would a letter of condolence that they didn't really think about or care so much about, just a safe face, would that have been so difficult? They didn't even do that. Maybe that says a little bit more about 1980s society also. There was less PR, a need for PR. I think today people would put out statements even if they didn't mean it. And is that any better? I don't know. But the fact that they didn't pretend to care, even though, you know, young people had lost their lives in London as well. It's not even like it was in, you know, not that it would make it better, but a remote part of the country that no one really knew about and didn't get the news. People got the news. People knew. Because they knew enough to place blame. So they must have known enough to send condolences. After pressure from clergymen in the community and Sybil Phoenix, letters of condolence were eventually sent 5 weeks after the massacre and after the Stardust nightclub fire. And the clear pressure that was coming from the Lewisham and wider community. This absence of the letter showed how little they cared about black people's suffering, their lives, their pain, their dead children, their safety. Especially at a point where it was widely believed that this was an arson attack conducted by the far right. And there were no answers as to who had done this. So it's not like it was, oh, it was all tied up, you know, it was decided it was this or that or the other, and answers were forthcoming and conclusive. There were no conclusions. There still are no conclusions, which probably adds to the pain and the lack of justice for families that have survived and that are, you know, generations on, still in this country, still dealing with the British state. But I think this also highlighted the need for black people and also those who cared, allies, others within other communities that felt that an injustice was occurring and wanted wider society to hear them, to feel their pain, to understand the trauma, as all protest movements tend to be about. the Black People's Day of Action was set for the 2nd of March 1981. The march was set to begin in New Cross, at the point of which the fire had started in January. It was to head to Fleet Street, which is where the press offices were in central London, go past the Houses of Parliament and end outside New Scotland Yard, heading past the key institutions that had failed them, not only in this instance, but more broadly too. It's also very interesting, and I said I had Caribbean movements, protest movements in my mind, but within movements and uprisings of agricultural workers like the Morant Bay Rebellion in 1865, protesters and marchers would go past police stations, government buildings, places of institutional significance and importance. And it's interesting that whilst there would have been obviously nobody alive in 1865 that was at the Black People's Day of Action, it feels like the same spirit of protesting, of resistance, of rebellion. It feeds through with Caribbean people into Britain. It feeds through marginalised people more broadly. You know, the kind of shouts and chants and needs and wants of people protesting, and that is to get the people with power, the people within these institutions to listen, to stand up, to take note, to stop or to do or to change. It's just clear that these are, you know, cyclical things, patterns that are occurring and can be kind of pulled out historically. The route was actually changed and updated a little bit closer to the time because there was a Labour early day motion that was trying to gain support of the protest. But I think within that, they had to avoid Parliament in order for that to go through. At this point, interestingly enough, there were 12 people dead and 26 injured. But unfortunately, Paul Ruddock passed away in this kind of time frame where flyers had been printed and or mock-ups had been done, shall we say, and organising was happening. And Paul Ruddock, Armsa Ruddock's son, passes, brother of Yvonne, whose birthday party it was. And so the flyers changed then to 13 dead and 26 injured. This eventually becomes 13 dead and nothing said and is popularised as kind of one of the slogans of the march, through poetry, through the voices of those who are creating art by way of poems, stories, literature. At that time, Lyndon Kwesi Johnson, Benjamin Zephaniah, Johnny Osborne, Aswad, and others too. The protest followed a coffin. There were photos held of the dead, giving face, giving name to those who had lost their lives. A lot of the photography that comes out of that day that we kind of know and probably could recognise come from Ron Ware. And I think when you do look at photographs, and I would urge you to do that because obviously we're just an audio podcast and you can't see the kind of emotions that are clearly portrayed in the photography through, you know, information on a podcast. I think you can feel an energy of the march through the protest pictures. I think you can feel the pain, the looks on people's faces, the sadness, the frustration, the anger. It's all there. It's all there in the photographs, the chants, you know. It's there in the music, it's there in the literature, it's there in the documentaries and the exhibitions that have been published and have resulted following on from the People's Day of Action. The press, the police and the state behaved exactly as expected. They berated the protesters. They called them looters and rioters, using racialised language and coded words and stereotypes in the headlines that followed. They harassed the protesters. They didn't follow protest conduct in some cases when it came to stewarding, and did as the Metropolitan Police often do. I haven't called out the London Metropolitan Police in a long time. I've missed it. That is how I know I haven't done an episode on Black British history in this for a second. London Metropolitan Police doing what they do best, working as agents of the state to oppress, to fill an imperialist and colonial agenda that they have not departed from. The funny thing about this episode is if you take away the specifics of the New Cross fire and the Black Lives Lost that led to the People's Day of Action, and obviously all the kind of specific context to this one thing, this event, you might so clearly see the similarities to the present moment that I started this episode with, of university protests and encampments and occupations, a lack of care for the death of innocent people, protests that follow to remind society that as marginalised people, we are still here. We are mourning the lives lost. We are facing overzealous policing, far-right press, mislabelling protesters and their intentions, and both operating to serve an imperialist agenda that they were both created for in the first place. Protest is a radical and powerful course of action, seen globally, historically, and in so many different contexts. In the case of London, 1981, it somewhat changed the course and direction of black political life in Britain. We've seen black people in Britain take to the streets to protest numerous injustices. The unlawful killing of Mark Duggan in 2011, the devastating Grenfell fire in 2017, again, where very little was said by those in power by way of condolences and sympathies, and George Floyd's murder in 2020, and the global response to racial injustice everywhere. The spirit of resistance lives in marginalised people worldwide and continues to be a light in this world that simply cannot be dimmed. Long may it shine. That's it for another episode of the History Hotline. If you enjoyed it, please rate and review us on whatever podcast platform you listen to, or tell a friend to tell a friend. To continue the conversation, follow us on social media at The History Hotline on Instagram and at The History HL on Twitter. The History Hotline is hosted by me, Deanna Lynn Cook. Research and marketing done by Zakia Riaz. Production by Waylon Mackenzie Witter. And original music provided by Royal Sounds. Sponsored by Musetopia. History Hotline.